Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine, full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, we're going to cover something that we have not focused in depth on at all in the course of all our podcasts, our clinical focus podcasts, as well as our specialist interviews. Today, we're going to talk to an individual who has some very, very important things to say about autoimmune disease. We currently are experiencing an epidemic of autoimmune diseases in America and throughout the developing world. And there may be some commonalities in terms of causation. And there also may be some hints as to what we can do to curb this, the terrible toll that these diseases are taking on our populace. And so without further ado, our guest today is Dr. David Brady. He is a very versatile individual because he's a naturopathic physician, but he's also a chiropractor. He's an ND, DC, and we can also append several other initials to his name, to his credentials. He's also a CCN, a certified clinical nutritionist, so he combines all those attributes into one package. And oh, by the way, he's vice provost for the Division of Health Sciences and interim dean of the College of Naturopathic Medicine, director of the Human Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. So those are very, very prestigious titles. He additionally finds time to be the chief medical officer for Designs for Health, a very excellent and innovative company that designs specialist products for physicians like myself. And he has lectured all over the place to prestigious academic conferences. He's published peer-reviewed scientific papers, and including chapters, one that is in a very excellent textbook of gastroenterology that has been written by one of our intelligent medicine guests, Dr. Mullen, Dr. Gerard Mullen. And so, without further ado, and with that introduction, have I missed anything, David?
No, I was just thinking, Dr. Hoffman, I really should have given you a much shorter bio. I'm getting hearing that one myself. You know?
Okay. Okay, time's up. It was a great interview, so
yes, exactly.
We're out of time now. So, no, I didn't want to cut into the meat of our discussion. But in front of me, I have an article, which is a great article, but it's really a mouthful. It's entitled Molecular Mimicry, The Hygiene Hypothesis, Stealth Infections, and Other Examples of Disconnect Between Medical Research and the Practice of Clinical Medicine in Autoimmune Disease, and is published in a journal of in the Journal of Rheumatology and Autoimmune Disease last year. So you wrote, I think, a very influential article in that journal, which probably is a journal that is devoted primarily to the discussion of conventional therapies, new drug breakthroughs, perhaps, you know, talking about some of the fancy new immunosuppressive medications that we see frequently advertised on TV. Yet you bring a different perspective to this, which is about lifestyle and about diet and about other hidden causes of autoimmunity. So what prompted you to get interested in this?
Desperation. So many patients coming in with these problems and having to try to really figure this out to offer them something more than just immunosuppressive drugs that may certainly help them symptomatically if they're far down the line into the disease process, but have little, you know, annoying side effects like, you know, lymphoma, leukemia, you know, cancers of various types. So
I might interrupt you just at this point to tell you just briefly about a patient that I saw who had ulcerative colitis and autoimmune disease. He was placed on one immunosuppressive medication. It didn't work. And then he went on another and that worked. But suddenly he started to develop enlarged lymph glands, felt really lousy. And it took him about a month or two before they figured out that he had tuberculosis.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
You know, and as you know, that is one of the rare but real side effects of these immunosuppressive medications. So he traded ulcerative colitis for a case of tuberculosis, had to be on a five-drug combination for 17 months to eradicate it.
Right. And my point is not that those medications are never indicated and aren't helpful in people who are really suffering from, you know, pretty progressed autoimmune, you know, destructive disorders, inflammatory joint disease, and so forth. But, you know, there's more than just waiting until it's that bad and doing that. And the more upstream or proactive we can get in the management of these conditions and even the prevention of these conditions, because there's many tools available, they're just not being used. I wanted to get that word out into, not into just an integrative medicine journal or a functional medicine journal and really preaching to the choir, if, you know, essentially to the docs who practice like I do, but really getting it out there into more of a mainstream autoimmune rheumatology journal to try to get this on the radar screen of these practitioners who just don't seem to be aware of these things we'll discuss today, even though they are well established in the medical literature. They just don't spill over into the day-in, day-out practice of clinical medicine in those specialties, unfortunately. And I think they should. I think we're doing our patients a disservice when we don't offer these things to them and even use some of the things we'll talk about in a very proactive manner in screening patients, particularly those with a strong family history of autoimmune disease or we know have some sort of genetic susceptibility to them, that we might be able to stop them from ever having it and ever being actually diagnosed with it in the first place if we just looked and just took some proactive steps to stop the train from rolling down the tracks toward autoimmunity.
And that's the very essence of the philosophy of naturopathic medicine,
exactly.
Which you earned a degree in, which is to use a not an allopathic approach. I mean, clearly there's a need sometimes to put the fire out, but sometimes to find out what's causing the fire and attempt to slow the progression of a disease by addressing causes. So let's examine why is it that autoimmune disease seems to be increasing in prevalence and in particular in the developed or industrialized world, you know, Western Europe, United States, now more advanced countries in Asia and throughout the world?
Well, if you look at the epidemiology, it's really alarming. If you look at the incidence of these autoimmune disorders, it could be multiple sclerosis, it could be Crohn's disease, it can be type 1 diabetes, it can be asthma, it can be, you know, fill in the blank, rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, lupus, right on down the line. Clearly, the incidence is skyrocketing. It's of epidemic proportions, and it's really too fast of a phenomena to be explained by genetics, by just a better diagnosis, more appreciation of the disorder. It's off the charts different. I mean, when you look at like a classic autoimmune disorder such as various inflammatory. Inflammatory bowel diseases, let's just say. The incidence of those disorders at the turn of last century, let's say, you know, just a little bit over 100 years ago, the incidence of inflammatory bowel disease then was about 1 in 10,000 subjects in the Western industrialized countries. Now it's about 1 in 250.
Hmm.
So that's like at the level of a infectious outbreak. I mean, this is massive increase in incidence. Similar data exists with asthma, hay fever, diabetes, MS, you name it. And when you look at it geographically, these disorders are incredibly prevalent in the Western developed countries, North America and United States, Canada, in Eastern and Western Europe, more so in Western Europe, and less so in countries like Australia and South America, and much less in the sort of developing world or the third world, if you will. And there's lots of different reasons that are probably in play and a lot of different hypotheses, and one of these hypotheses is called the hygiene hypothesis. And that is that a big difference between the sort of underdeveloped world or the third world is versus the Western industrialized world is that they live in relative filth compared to us. they still live in squalor, basically. You got one village upstream, you know, going to the bathroom in the water and throwing their waste in the water, bathing in the water, and then downstream the village takes the water and, you know, and drinks it. And
I sometimes think of the movie Slumdog Millionaire, if you remember
exactly.
That movie, where this the poor kid, they played a prank on him. He went to sit in a privy, and somebody had rigged it up so that he'd fall down into what seemed like a geological stratum of, you know, decades of poop. But after the immersion in the poop, he probably came out, you know, if he survived it, and some of these kids unfortunately succumb to infectious diseases, and that's the trade-off. Right. If you survive the onslaught of those germs, you're going to have a pretty robust immune system.
Well, yeah, and we, you know, today, just think of a kid born today in the United States, in suburban U.S., right? I mean, they live in an environment that's so foreign to their genes from, you know, what humans lived in even 50 or 100 years ago, let alone a couple thousands of years ago. You know, they live in this false existence, you know? They're in these sterile, semi-sterile little boxes we called houses with carpets and draperies and paint, everything off-gassing, so they're getting, you know, bombarded with tons of chemicals, but they're not sampling a real-world environment. They're not in the dirt. They're not digging in the dirt, laying in the dirt, picking food out of the ground and eating a little dirt along with the food that they're eating.
So no barnyard animals. And actually, some studies
exactly.
show that kids who are raised on farms have a lower incidence of asthma. You think with all the exposure to animals, they might become sensitized to pet dander. But in fact, they actually have less allergies.
Absolutely. And not only, certainly kids who grow up on traditional farms have much less atopic disorders, you know, asthma, hay fever. They're just not sensitized as much from an allergy standpoint, and we know that, and there's really, really good studies done showing the actual differences in the way the immune system expresses itself when challenged in children who grow up in suburban and urban environments versus rural environments. But even kids that grow up in suburban or urban environments, if they just have a pet in the house, such as a dog or a cat, they actually have less allergenic disease. And they've actually looked at which organisms may actually be playing a role in that and so forth. But the big take-home message is we live in this false clean environment, and there are certainly benefits to that. I mean, we don't have the infectious outbreaks and the things like that that we used to with modern hygiene and sewage treatment, and we live in these clean environments. But the price we pay is we don't sample our environment nearly enough growing up now, and sooner or later we're going to confront some bad guys, right? Some bacteria, some viruses, some parasites, or what have you. We can't be shielded forever. And if we didn't learn during the sort of developmental phase of our immune system to get along with a lot of other organisms that we share the planet with and only react to those that truly present a significant threat to us, then we start viewing every foreign antigen as a threat. Then when we're eating certain foods with certain proteins that our immune system doesn't recognize, or we have certain bacteria or viruses we're exposed to, or we have a bacteria that overgrows in the intestinal tract as an opportunistic organism, we can react immunologically to that, and it can actually trigger autoimmunity. We can be reacting against one of these bacteria, let's say, in the gut, against one of the proteins expressed on this bacteria, and if that protein looks a lot like one of the proteins on a host tissue, we can start getting an overzealous reaction to the point where we can't discriminate the subtle difference between the bacteria on the or the protein on the bacteria or the virus we're trying to react to, and the protein on our own tissues, and we actually direct our immune system against our own tissue. And I can give you an example: people who have rheumatoid arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. These are inflammatory joint diseases. When we look at the bacteria and we map the bacteria that are growing in their intestinal tract, it looks very different from people who don't have those diseases and people who are so-called normal. They actually have an overexpression of a couple of organisms. One is Klebsiella and the other Citrobacter species. And we know this. We can map it. And we know that there's proteins expressed on these organisms that have a similar structure to some of the proteins on the synovial joint linings of the joints that are affected in these autoimmune disorders. So our body's trying to beat down this overgrowth or infection in the gastrointestinal environment of these organisms by attacking a certain protein unique to those bugs, but that protein is similar enough to one of our tissues that we lose discrimination and we actually start attacking those specific joints. And that's called molecular mimicry, and that term was in the title of that paper that I talked about. And that's just one example. We know many, many different associations of molecular mimicry. There's overgrowth of a bacteria called Yersinia enterocolitica in the guts of people, a lot of people, not everybody, who has autoimmune thyroiditis like Hashimoto's disease, Graves' disease.
Yersinia species, I think it's the same species, it's not the same bacteria, but it's a species that the plague comes from, right? Yersinia pestis is the causes of the plague. I mean, you don't get the plague, but it's a nasty bug.
Right. Same genus, but different species. So there's a lot of these different associations, and they've shown now it's not just association, because association does not mean causality, but they've done studies actually showing that, for instance, there's something that's pretty common among autoimmune diseases, and that is that they wax and wane. And any doctor knows that as you see these patients. People with rheumatoid arthritis or people with multiple sclerosis
They flare.
Yeah, they flare, and then they get better, and then they get worse, and then they get better. And no one has really quite explained this, but when you look at a rheumatoid arthritis patient, I have several studies I cite in that paper. When they look at the composition of the bacteria in their guts when they're not flared, when they feel okay, their bacteria in their guts look like normal people. But when they flare, the bacteria in their gut has a much different profile, and they have this overexpression of Klebsiella and Citrobacter and others. And they've actually mapped this tightly enough to where, you know, they answered the chicken or egg kind of question, and that is, the microbiota or the bacteria shift in their pattern before the symptoms come back. So it's not the disease process apparently driving the shift in the bacterial population. It's actually the effects of the bacterial population shift that may be driving the disease.
I sometimes use a crude analogy of, say there's a Brinks armored truck and there's a holdup going on. But the Brinks armored truck is backed up with, a police detail, and the police then fire at the robbers indiscriminately. And they hit some of the robbers, but they also there's some collateral damage.
Sure,
they hit some of the innocent bystanders, and it's a form of collateral damage. It's actually the immune system doing its job, but over exuberantly and non selectively.
Well, I mean, that's what's going on in diabetes type 1, for instance, right? What used to be called juvenile onset diabetes. It's interesting. You got these young, healthy people who one day they're fine. The next day they pass out. No one knows what's wrong with them. They get taken to a hospital or to a physician. They do some blood work, and they find out their blood sugar's through the roof. Yesterday they were fine. What happened? Well, apparently what happens is they're exposed to some sort of offending protein or antigen. It could be there's viruses implicated. There's even the proteins expressed in certain insect venoms if they get bit by a bug or a wasp or something. But one of the most common triggers for type 1 diabetes is when you have a genetically susceptible child that is given cow's milk as they're growing up, and they're confronted with cow's milk every day.
And that's not all kids. You have to have a certain genetic susceptibility.
No, just the genetically susceptible ones. And there's a protein in cow's milk called bovine albumin peptide, and it has a structure that's very similar in its amino acid motif or a composition to the proteins that are expressed on the islet cells in the pancreas, which make insulin. So if you give this genetically susceptible child milk growing up, they're constantly reacting to it. Their immune system doesn't get along with it. And finally, it gets to a point of being so intolerant to it and so overreactive to it, it stops being able to discriminate between the subtle difference between that cow's milk protein and the protein on the patient's own pancreatic cells that make insulin, and they cross over. They have a molecular mimicry phenomena, and they basically throw antibodies onto this protein on the cells of the pancreas, directing the rest of their immune cells to basically destroy the pancreatic or insulin-producing pancreatic cells, and it happens very rapidly in this disorder, and all of a sudden overnight they end up, you know, type 1 diabetic.
Well, this doesn't necessarily argue for children not ever receiving milk, but it may argue for possibly screening the relatives of patients with type 1 diabetes, the offspring,
exactly.
The kids, and maybe see if they have the susceptibility gene, and then possibly withholding dairy products until the child reaches a certain age, or maybe indefinitely, because there's not necessarily 100%, but there's a fairly high probability that this could result in an autoimmune attack on the pancreas.
Absolutely. And these associations I'm talking about, I just want to caution everybody, they're not universal. They're not, you know, one-to-one, you know, lockdown relationships where this is the only cause of type 1 diabetes, or Yersinia is the only cause of Hashimoto's, or Klebsiella is the only cause of rheumatoid arthritis. There's many pathways in. These are just some of the triggers that we know of, but many of these disorders have a multitude of triggers. So, and we probably don't know more of them than we know, but the ones that we do know, there are proactive strategies. There's tests available where we can actually determine who are the people who will have these disorders 7, 10, 15 years down the line before they would ever be clinically diagnosed. We can take the precautions to make sure they're not exposed to these outside environmental proteins as much as possible. And there are other mechanisms that we can use to block the autoimmune phenomena through other pathways. So there's really an opportunity here for a very proactive preventive strategy of deterring autoimmune disease. And the one I mentioned with diabetes, for instance, I would go further than just screening children with strong family histories of type 1 diabetes. I would screen all children just
universal screening.
Yeah. Because it's not that expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting type 1 diabetes when you're, and very young in life is bad. I mean,
right.
The prognosis is not good.
Well, we do a lot for certain diseases that are very rare in children. Hepatitis. We want to give the hepatitis vaccine to kids, and that kids rarely get it. We give the rotavirus vaccine to kids, and they rarely get it. So perhaps, and this is a much more prevalent disease, maybe we should be more proactive about screening. I wanted to throw in this angle. Talking about the hygiene hypothesis, there's actually some really fascinating research ongoing, I'm sure you're aware of it, in relationship to something called Ovamed therapy for colitis, but also for related autoimmune disorders. It's actually introducing a parasite. People swallow a vial of live roundworms, or actually roundworm eggs in this case, into their intestinal tracts in order to counteract autoimmunity. What's up with that?
Well, that's really interesting stuff. I mean, a colleague of mine who I've followed his work for a very long time, named Joel Weinstock, is probably the preeminent researcher here. He did a lot of this work at the University of Iowa initially, and he's moved on to Tufts University. But, he looked at this phenomenon of inflammatory bowel disease being so much more prevalent now. And they've noticed in other countries, underdeveloped countries, let's say, for instance, there was a situation in Vietnam and Cambodia where when Westerners went in there, partly during the war experience there, a lot of the children were just infested with helminths or worms, and they wanted to help them. So they gave them anti-parasitic, anti-helminth agents, and sure enough, they killed the parasites off. But when they did that, all of a sudden, these kids started having asthma and hay fever and all the stuff that the kids in the U.S. have, and they started figuring out these relationships. And many researchers, Weinstock being one of them, looked at this in detail and actually figured out that over time, as humans became sort of adaptable to the parasites, the worms that infested us for hundreds of thousands of years while we've been on the planet, that one of the ways that the parasite survives in our gut is it doesn't want to kill us, because it wants to sort of live in us and have sort of a symbiotic relationship.
Hitch a ride.
Yeah, hitch a ride. And so the organism doesn't want to get killed. So it actually secretes different messenger molecules and peptides and proteins that have an effect on the mucosal immune system or the immune system of the intestines. And it down-regulates it. It makes it less aggressive against this parasite. Over time, the human adapted to this, and it sort of reacted in a way that brought back up the immune response, and they sort of found a happy balance, or a homeostasis, if you will. Over the last 100 years or so with modern hygiene and use of modern medications and so forth, and, you know, standardization of the food supply, we've eradicated a lot of these helminth or worm-like organisms. Now, that's really a short amount of time, 50 or 100 years. It's not enough for our genes and our immune expression to necessarily entirely catch up and adapt. But so if we pull these helminth organisms or worms out of the human intestines, we're left now with the ratcheted up immune response of the human expecting the worm to be there, but yet we don't have the down-regulating effect of the organism. So the immune system of the gut is left in too aggressive or hyperactive of a stance, and you're overreactive to all the things that you can get exposed to, and this can actually help drive molecular mimicry, autoimmunity, inflammation of the gut. It can lead to leaky gut, which is another component of autoimmunity. So what Weinstock did and other researchers is they actually introduced worm organisms or helminths into people with inflammatory bowel disease, such as Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. And they picked most of the studies picked a organism called Trichuris suis, which is porcine whipworm. It comes from the pig. If you introduce it into humans, it will have the same immune modulating effect as whipworms that normally grow in humans. But what's the good thing about the porcine whipworm is if you don't keep giving it, it won't survive. It'll be gone within 2 or 3 days, 4 days at most, from the human GI tract. But what they noticed is when they introduced those organisms into people with inflammatory bowel disease, they actually got much better symptomatically. Mm. And they've mapped out the changes that occur. It actually favorably alters innate immune response or cytokine expression and induces a bunch of beneficial T-cell regulatory changes. It blocks effector T-cell proliferation. It actually changes the intestinal flora or the microbes that grow in the gut in a favorable way. So they were going down drug development paths with this over many years, and actually it's an improved drug in Europe. Ovamed and others are out there which are based on this technology. It's in trial still in the U.S. It's not approved by
I think they're doing some work at Einstein, and they're even looking at its effect on MS and autism, I believe.
Absolutely. It can affect all autoimmune diseases. It's interesting, though, there was a San Diego-based biosciences company that was teamed up with a German group, and they were actually doing a lot of research on this, and they actually just pulled the study in process on Crohn's disease because it was not working very well. It seems that it does not work as well in Crohn's disease as it does in ulcerative colitis. So the jury's still out on it from a more granular standpoint, but I think there's great promise there. And it sort of proves out to a large degree, the whole concept of the hygiene hypothesis.
Okay, well, this is a good inflection point for us to pause, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So let's stipulate this is part one. When we return, we're going to look at some other causes of autoimmune diseases, and we'll focus on common conditions like autoimmune thyroiditis, the main cause of loss of thyroid function, particularly in women in this country, very, very prevalent, tens of millions suffering from it. And we'll tackle exposure to chemicals, we'll talk nutrition, we'll talk about leaky gut, and more with today's guest. He's Dr. David Brady. He's at the University of Bridgeport. He's an NDDC, a naturopath, and a chiropractor, also a certified clinical nutritionist, and he brings his own unique perspective to the problem of autoimmunity. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine.